Hi, I'm Jeremy Kirk with Intel 471, and welcome to another installment of Studio 471. I'm speaking with Megan Stiefel, who's the Chief Strategy Officer with the Institute for Security and Technology. Thank you very much for joining me, Megan.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your background is as an attorney, and that's led you to some really interesting jobs at the intersection of sort of government, legal, and cyber spheres. Tell me a little bit about your background.
Sure. I, as you noted, I'm an attorney. I by trade, by training, I went to law school actually after spending a couple of years on the Hill, and worked on the House Select Intelligence Committee before 9/11, which really kind of led me into the pathway of pursuing a career in national security law, and then joined the Department of Justice in 2006, longer ago than I probably want to admit, worked first as an attorney supporting the government's national security surveillance activities. Under U.S. law, the government has to go to a particular court in order to obtain authority to conduct surveillance and physical searches of U.S. persons in the United States. So that's the work that I did. And that experience gave me the opportunity to kind of be in the right place at the right time as the government was really stepping up its work around cybersecurity policy. The body of law that applies to the government's ability to collect foreign intelligence information or to conduct surveillance for law enforcement purposes is part of the body of law that governs the government's ability to undertake cybersecurity activities. So it was kind of the right place at the right time. And so I was fortunate to really dive into this work as the government was working, the U.S. government was working on something called the Comprehensive National Cybersecurity Initiative, which was really the government getting its own house in order. And now we've kind of come almost full circle to this year's National Cybersecurity Strategy that the government issued in the spring. And here we're seeing the government really looking at not only its own activities, but the activities that they want to see from the private sector. So it's been a great decade and a half or so of, I guess, a little bit more than that now, of watching the evolution of policy in this space, both from the government's perspective and also now as a member of civil society, where I serve as the Chief Strategy Officer at the Institute for Security and Technology, and thinking about how the multi-stakeholder model can support effective governance around cybersecurity.
So the Institute is behind the Ransomware Task Force, which, of course, is this coalition that's united to fighting ransomware. Tell me a little bit more about the task force and its aims.
Sure. So we, the Institute for Security and Technology, where I am, is a Bay Area-based nonprofit organization. We're about 6.5, 7 years old, and we work to bridge the gap between technologists and policymakers to outpace emerging security threats. And in the early days of the pandemic, so 2020, we saw a lot of ransomware incidents affecting a range of critical infrastructure. So in the early 2010s, ransomware was more of a nuisance, particularly targeting smaller organizations, not exclusively, but smaller organizations, small businesses, individuals. In 2020, we saw a rapid increase in the amount of ransomware that was affecting critical infrastructure, both in the United States and elsewhere. And we were concerned that enough attention wasn't being paid by government stakeholders, as well as industry, in coming together to better combat this threat. Assessing also that largely the threat is emanating out of Russia and nearby states. So we convened a group of stakeholders from a range of sectors, including the government, but also industry, academia, and more civil society members. And in the end, had over 60 plus participants in this effort that in the end developed 48 recommendations to help organizations better prepare for ransomware incidents, better respond to ransomware incidents, looked at measures to better disrupt the ransomware ecosystem, and finally looking at ways to deter ransomware, both kind of diplomatically, but also one could imagine through collective efforts in building all three of those other three pieces: prepare, respond, and disrupt.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, so that launched in 2021, and now we're 2 years on, and the RTF issued a status report earlier this year. Can you tell me some of the successes that were cited and then some of the challenges that kind of remain in this battle?
Yes. So we this spring, we assessed that we are making solid progress. We talked about the continued commitment to combat ransomware threats through increasing public, private, and government-to-government collaboration to disrupt incidents. And we saw even more of those since we issued the report this spring. We also saw an increasing focus on reporting and information sharing. And one example of that is the recently passed, it's been a little over a year now, something we call CERCEA. And then the other piece that we really observed was ongoing efforts to reduce some of the risks posed by cryptocurrency, thinking in particular about measures by financial regulators, as well as actual regulated entities in making more effective use of suspicious activity reports and the like to support those disruptive efforts that we identified in the first of those three key observations.
And CERCEA, you know, CISA is right now drafting some regulations sort of around that. I think it's calling for reporting of cyber incidents within 72 hours, and then also the reporting of ransomware payments within 24 hours. When that gets sort of settled and that gets in place, what do you think is going to be the benefit then of having, I guess, more accurate stats on ransomware, particularly as it at least applies to critical infrastructure?
Yeah, I mean, overall, we assess that the information environment is what we call suboptimal. And what we mean by that is that even in the takedown of the Hive effort over the spring, the Department of Justice noted that based on their information, only 20% of ransomware incidents were reported to the government. And that's one of the best examples of this suboptimal information environment. So we think that the CERCEA will help reduce that sub-optimization or move us towards more Pareto optimal in the sense that particularly its requirement to report to the government if a ransom is paid. It's critical, though, that even with the reporting of a payment, that what also needs to accompany that information. And we assess and have written some research around what makes for an optimal ransomware report, including things like the wallet that the ransom is paid to, the amount of the demand, the amount that the victim actually paid. But in addition to those payment details, really looking at the method or the tactics, techniques, and procedures that the actors use to gain access to the network. Of course, the challenge with that is that that's often not known in 72 hours. And so one of the other key elements of our paper from last fall, which was a cyber incident reporting framework paper that we published in November, I believe, of last year, was this idea that reports ideally should be able to be updated. And one presumes then that if there's an ability to update or augment the initial report that's filed, the government can then leverage this updated information, which might include some additional TTPs, to build a more holistic picture of how these actors are gaining access. And one example is to think, well, if they're leveraging access brokers at a particular, which are those actors that initially gain access to a system, a network, an enterprise, and then sell that access or pass that access off to a different set of ransomware actors. If we're able to build a more common operating picture of where these access brokers are building their tooling or other kind of key indicators of how we might disrupt these activities, that could have a domino effect in ransomware incidents overall. So by this additional and broader ability to collect really specific information, particularly around ransomware, but it wouldn't necessarily need to be limited to ransomware. We think that, for example, in business email compromise cases and other types of hopefully activities that fall within the requirements of CERCEA, that if the government leverages its ability to collect this information, it could really have a significant impact on not only the government's ability to combat these activities, but its ability to partner with the private sector to have a really kind of knockdown punch on malicious actors.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I want to talk about ransoms. Of course, this is and whether to ban ransoms or whether to, leave it as the status quo. And I don't expect us, first of all, to be able to solve this problem in this conversation by any means, because it's very complex. But I think it's interesting, you know, there's been some news that surfaced recently that it looks like the U.S. may ask other countries to make a pledge to, for governments at least, to not pay ransoms, which I think is quite interesting. You know, in the United States, there's been a couple different states that have said, you know, we're not going to pay ransoms. Have actually passed sort of legislation around it. You know, the RTF a couple of years ago didn't take a position on it because the you know, the experts were divided on whether that would be an effective method. So is this a really evolving issue? And why do you think we're circling around back to this again?
Yes. Well, I think a couple of reasons. One of the unfortunate, but probably biggest, is that while we noted in the spring of this year when we published our progress report that incidents in 22 were down, and we offered a number of reasons why we thought that might be the case, including the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Unfortunately, as the year has gone on, ransom payments and ransom incidents have increased. And so this return to actual payments, the increase in the number of incidents, has, I think, prompted policymakers to really re-examine whether there might be additional opportunities for them to consider new tools or augmenting tools that the government might have at its disposal to try to reduce the ability of organizations to pay, which we then think will, of course, drive down the number, the desire. If the crooks aren't getting paid, they likely will not want to. They will hopefully turn to some other type of crime. But the other piece I think to say about the idea of banning payments is, we initially were concerned that with a payment ban, if only instituted by the United States, would have limited effect. It might, among other things, play a game of chicken for victims in the United States with these threat actors, but also may drive the actors to target more vulnerable populations outside the United States. Now that the counter-ransomware initiative is in place, this is an effort that the White House has established and now counts over 40 countries as members. The ability to issue or kind of consider a ban such as that could be more effective. But we still think that there are a number of considerations that need to be given before a payment ban might be issued.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, taxpayers, the idea of using taxpayer money to pay cyber criminals ransoms, right, is insane. Like, no, that's not going to be something that's going to be tenable. I mean, at least here in Australia, too, the idea of governments paying paying ransoms has always been off the table. I wonder if, you know, in the insurance industry, you know, that there's a lot to kind of play in this as well. You know, there's signs that the insurance industry, at least some insurers, are going to stop reimbursing ransoms. You know, there have been people who've said it was a bad road for insurance agencies to go down to even reimburse ransoms in the first place. And I almost feel like maybe this is a problem that will sort of at least partially sort of solve itself as more insurance agencies say, hey, you know, you could pay a ransom, but we're not going to reimburse it anymore. And I think that maybe that's a good incremental step to even take before, you know, sort of like a hard ban and the complexities of that sort of ban. And then also when you have governments say, you know, we're not going to pay either, maybe that'll be enough that, when certain actions happen in certain parts of industries, others kind of take it on board. Do you think that that might be, some of this might potentially get solved on its own?
I do think, yes, I think the moves by insurers to reduce or eliminate the reimbursement for payments could support decrease the likelihood of victims to make a payment. But also, I think, and you just touched on this a bit as well, is the idea that I think when we first issued the report, it was a soft insurance market, meaning that it was easier for victims. There were fewer requirements, for applicants to get insurance. In the ensuing years, the market has shifted and it's now much more of a harder market, meaning that there are more requirements on applicants before they are able to obtain cyber insurance. And we think this move also will hopefully harden organizations and make them less likely to fall victim to ransomware incidents in the first place, which then hopefully means that then there are fewer payouts. We also, though, think that an additional factor that might let this all sort of maybe hopefully lead to it sorting itself off is the idea that, or is the fact now that in the US, the government is offering grant money to a range of organizations to help them better prepare for incidents. And some of these funds can also be used to help organizations better respond to incidents. This actually aligns with a recommendation that we had made in our task force report, which was there needed to be additional funds to help organizations move away from, in many cases, outdated technologies, software that's beyond its support timeframe. So it's end of life software. And now actually just this fall, these funds are making their way. They were actually appropriated and they've made their way over to DHS in the United States. And so the idea that other governments might also follow an approach of supporting through preparatory measures as opposed to post-incident payouts is something that we think will also hopefully contribute to a more resilient ecosystem and then likely decrease the amount of incidents and hopefully the amount of payouts as well.
And that has been a focus of the ransomware task force too, is just better defenses, right? Getting companies prepared, trying to get companies to follow maybe a cybersecurity framework. And we should talk a bit about the blueprint for ransomware defense, which is an important component of the RTF as well. And so the blueprint for ransomware defense is what, how about you tell me about it?
Sure. One of the recommendations was that, there needed to be a concise list of resources, cybersecurity controls, in more simpler terms, measures that organizations undertake to enhance the resilience of their networks, enhance the security of their networks. And so over a period of almost a year, I think we formed a small working group, including the Center for Internet Security, the Global Cyber Alliance, Act Zero, Resilience, the cyber insurance company, and a few others, and looked at the existing controls recommendations. So the Center for Internet Security supports, developed something called the Critical Controls, and it's now actually in its eighth version. And we looked at that controls framework and examined kind of what, together with the MITRE ATT&CK framework and something called the community defense model, lots of jargon here, but which looks at which types of tactics are being inaccurately, improperly, or not being implemented whatsoever and are therefore leveraged by, in one case, it could be ransomware actors. They also have profiles, I think, that examine the business email compromise tactics and the like to see which controls would be most effective in combating a particular type of cybersecurity incident. So we married and analyzed the CDM MITRE ATT&CK and the Implementation Group 1 controls, which are the basic controls that CIS has identified, and narrowed narrowed the number of controls from 80 to 40. Still a lot for small and medium-sized enterprises, which is what the blueprint is targeted to. But we've also, through the great work of our friends over at CIS, identified a range of tooling that organizations can use. And in many cases, it's free. So the control, there are 40 controls. And to the right, if one goes to the page, it will show you some tooling that can be used to implement the particular control. So we're proud of the blueprint. We think it's been effectively received, and we're currently working, among other things, with a range of services providers, both MSPs, MSSPs, as well as, for example, AWS has mapped their offerings in their services to the blueprint. So one can know how much of the blueprint an AWS profile could support. And we hope that along the way, additional services providers can do a similar mapping effort so that organizations can differentiate among service providers who might be better equipped to support them in being more resilient against ransomware.
I really like the framework because I think it makes it more accessible for small businesses. You know, when you look at what ransomware gangs exploit, it often comes down to misconfigurations, a lack of patching, and poor access control. Do you find that the blueprint is helping sort of bridge that gap for less mature organizations?
Yes. I should note also that we, in the early part of this year, put together a six series webinar, set of webinars around implementation. So where we're taking the blueprint, the 40 controls, and breaking them down even further and stepping through how organizations can implement the blueprint, which hopefully makes it more, even more accessible. I often think about the blueprint on a spectrum where perhaps an organization that's just beginning its cybersecurity journey might first begin with the GCA, the Global Cyber Alliance Small Business Toolkit. And if they've been able to implement all of those measures, then looking at the blueprint as a next step, which going from kind of five or six controls that are in the GCA Small Business Toolkit over to the blueprint, which has then 40 controls, or even working again with their MSP, MSSP to see if they can have the MSP implement the controls for them. And then, of course, as organizations are even more mature, perhaps they are actually in a position to procure different additional services. Perhaps they suddenly find themselves as a much larger enterprise, in which case they should still implement the blueprint, but there are additional controls that are out there that can help more mature organizations enhance their resilience. I think the key, of course, with all of this is that please don't do nothing. We sort of say to folks, begin, as you said, with MFA. It's a great place to start. As you said, keeping patching up to date. One thing that I think is, I believe, in the blueprint, but is something that is often kind of overlooked is this idea of protective DNS. So using a service like Quad9, other browsers have similar services that will allow and block list different websites. And that's a great way to also avoid some of the early stages of ransomware attacks like phishing and the like.
Absolutely. Some of those accidental things that your employees make it tricked into doing.
Yes.
So as a final question, I just wanted to ask what's on the IST's research agenda around ransomware. You've done some terrific reports, especially on like the crypto payments economy. What else is in the on the horizon?
Yes. So we continue to work on that piece of research, which was the mapping the cryptocurrency payment ecosystem. And just a few weeks ago now published, actually it's been a couple of months now, published a mini pilot where we looked at some ransomware incidents and overlaid them across the map, payment map, to see where there are kind of hotspots and where there might be the places we might look to have the most impact through disruptive measures. Finding that in that case, or in those many cases, the infrastructure that's used by these actors to conduct their attacks is often reused. And so there might be opportunities to work internationally with partners to counteract and share information to combat this staging activity. We're also looking at what some of the barriers are to scaling disruption, and think that the map can be a useful guide in thinking about that as well, and looking at the existing mechanisms to share information among all of those entities that we identified: incident response firms, negotiating firms, financial institutions, cryptocurrency exchanges, blockchain analytic firms. There are a lot of eyes on this space, and so we do think that there is certainly an opportunity to enhance the ability for these eyes to connect to ears, or ones to connect to zeros, and pass information in a more scalable fashion to reduce the ongoing staging and payment process. So in addition to the cryptocurrency payment, sort of looking to frustrate payments, and really thinking about cash out also as a place, so where the actors move the money from cryptocurrencies back into fiat currency. We're also working to enhance victim notification. There is, again, kind of with this idea that there are lots of eyes in this ecosystem. Oftentimes there may be actors in the good actors, beneficial, benevolent actors in the research community and in industry who may see a ransomware attack unfolding. And so working to get to the victim before, having a race condition of it, get to the victim before the encryption is deployed, or before additional information is obtained, the confidentiality of information is removed. And thinking about ways to scale that work as well. So looking at collaborating with organizations like Shadow Server and the Forum for Incident Responders and Security Teams First to build a more global effort to enhance the victim notification possibilities. The other piece that we are really focused on this month is bringing the ransomware task force findings and tailoring them to regional and national audiences. So we're actually, our team will be in three different regions next week talking about ransomware, both in the ASEAN region at Singapore International Cyber Week. We have a team member attending the Europol conference, and then we have another team member attending the Organization for American States conference, it being Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Everyone is pulled in every direction, but really yes. Thinking about, as we talked about in the early part of our conversation, the rise or the return of ransomware affecting not only the United States, but also having greater effect overseas, and the need for not only through the Counter Ransomware Initiative, but for other efforts to bring countries into the conversation around ransomware and help them better prepare to manage this threat has been a primary focus for us this year. And I think we're seeing the fruits of that, which means that we're trying to meet audiences everywhere to talk about how they might use some of the findings that we have and tailor them to their communities to have maximum impact.
And that sounds like some terrific and well-needed outreach. Megan Stiefel, thank you very much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me.